Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.
Hello. This month's book is The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. The Historian is a modern retelling of the Dracula legend, taking some elements from Bram Stoker's famous novel, but adding much more in the way of background, history, and characters. It focuses on the premise that Vlad Dracul, also known as Vlad the Impaler, has survived and lives in hiding to this day. Following three linked narratives, the story unfolds over 50 years as the characters set out to find the truth about the subsequent disappearance of gifted academics. The starting point for each one is the sudden appearance of an ancient leather-bound book, empty apart from a woodcut of a dragon in the center pages, with the title Draculia written above it. These books mark the undead count's interest in the unlucky recipient and ultimately can lead to them being infected and added to his growing army of servants. The tale begins with the disappearance of Professor Rossi in unexplained circumstances, and his favourite student sets out to find and rescue his mentor. Using Rossi's notes and research, this journey takes him across Europe to Turkey, and then back through Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria in his search for the truth. He finally locates Rossi, who has been imprisoned by Dracula. The Count is seeking a scholar to act as a librarian for his vast secret collection of rare and ancient books, and has chosen Rossi for this task. He offers the professor a choice: to serve willingly and have a comfortable, if cursed, life, or to be infected and enslaved.
My dear daughter, if you're reading this, forgive me. I have gone to look for your mother. For many years, I have believed she was dead, and now I'm not certain about that. This uncertainty is almost worse than grief, as you may someday understand. It tortures my heart night and day. I have never told you much about her, and that has been a weakness in me, I know. But our story was too painful for me to relate to you easily. I'd always intended to tell you more as you grew older and could understand it better without being terribly frightened, although, as far as that goes, it has frightened me so much, so unendingly, that this has been the poorest of my excuses to myself about the matter. During the last few months, I've tried to compensate for my weakness by telling you little by little what I could about my own past, and I intended to bring your mother gradually into the story, although she entered my life rather suddenly. Now I fear I may not manage to tell you all you should know of your heritage before I am either silenced, literally unable to inform you myself, or fall prey again to my own silences. I have described to you some of my life as a graduate student before your birth, and have told you a little about the odd circumstance of my advisor's disappearance after his revelations to me. I have told you also how I met a young woman named Helen, who had as great an interest as mine in finding Professor Rossi, perhaps a greater one. At every quiet opportunity, I have tried to advance this story for you, but now I feel I should begin to write down the rest of it, commit it securely to paper. If you must read it now instead of listening to me unfold it for you on some rocky hilltop or quiet piazza, in some sheltered harbour or at some comfortable cafe table, then the fault is mine for not telling it quickly enough or sooner. As I write this, I am looking out over the lights of an old harbour, and you sleep undisturbed and innocent in the next room. I am tired after the day's work, and tired at the thought of beginning this long narrative, a sad duty, an unfortunate precaution. I feel I have some weeks, possibly months, in which I will certainly be able to continue my tale in person, so I will not retrace all the ground I have already covered for you during our strolls in so many countries. Past that stretch of time, weeks or months, I am less certain. These letters are my insurance against your solitude. In the worst case, you will inherit my house, my money, my furniture and books, but I can easily believe that you will treasure these documents in my hand more than any of the other items, because they will contain your own story, your history. Why have I not told you all the facts of this history at a blow to get it over with, to inform you fully? The answer lies again in my own weakness, but also in the fact that an abbreviated version would be exactly that, a blow. I can't possibly wish you such pain, even if it would be a mere fraction of my own. Furthermore, you might not fully believe it if I told it at a blow, just as I could not believe my adviser Rossi's story fully without pacing the length of his own reminiscences. And finally, what story can be reduced in actuality to its factual elements? Therefore, I relate my story one step at a time. I must hazard a guess, too, at how much I will have managed to tell you already if these letters come into your hands.
This is a very well-researched novel, with a wealth of historical and geographical detail, so much so that in some places it reads almost as a travelogue. The more easterly of the European countries are likely to be far less familiar to many readers, and Kostova does an excellent job of presenting them as vibrant and beautiful places. This is part of the pleasure for me, though I suspect some readers might find her detailed descriptions of the landscape intrude on the main story. Likewise, there is much historical detail that underpins the narrative. Whilst it is important for the understanding of the plot, it could be argued there is more than necessary to carry the story. The narrative comes from three points of view, both using three different characters and often telling the story from a different time. Kostova handles this complex structure with considerable skill, but it can be a little confusing sometimes, as one character can be retracing a journey as it is narrated by another. There is also a fair amount of moving back and forth between locations, cities, and countries, often in two or three time frames. Here, a map would have been helpful as a quick reference, especially as several locations, Ragusa for Dubrovnik, for example, are given in their ancient or Latin names.
Studchev looked almost as awed as I felt, although the sight of such an old manuscript must have been his daily fare. "I have translated it into Bulgarian," he said after a moment, and threw out another sheet, this one typed "onion skin." We sat down. "I will try to read it to you." He cleared his throat and gave us a rough but competent version of a letter that has since been widely translated. "Your Excellency, Lord Abbot Eupraxius, I take my pen in hand to fulfil the task you have in your wisdom put upon me, and to tell you the particulars of our mission as we come to them. May I do justice to them and to your wishes with God's assistance. We sleep this night near Verbius, 2 days' journey from you at the monastery of Saint Vladimir, where the Holy Brothers have welcomed us in your name. As you have instructed, I went alone to the Lord Abbot and told him our mission in the greatest secrecy, with not even a novice or servant present. He has commanded our wagon to remain under lock in the stables within the courtyard, with 2 guards from among his monks and 2 from among our number. I hope we may meet often with such understanding and safekeeping, at least until we cross into the infidel lands. As you have instructed, I placed 1 book in the Lord Abbot's hands with your injunctions, and saw that he hid it forthwith, not even opening it before me. The horses are tired after our climb through the mountains, and we will sleep here yet another night after this one. We ourselves are now well refreshed by the services of their church here, in which 2 icons of the most pure Virgin have performed miracles as recently as 80 years ago. One of them still shows the miraculous tears she wept for a sinner, which are now turned to rare pearls. We have offered earnest prayers to her for protection in our mission, that we may safely reach the great city, and even in the capital of the enemy, find a haven from which to attempt our task. I am yours, most humbly, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Brother Kirill, April, the year of our Lord, 6985. I think Helen and I hardly breathed as Stoichev read this aloud. He translated slowly and methodically and with no small skill. I was just about to exclaim aloud over the indubitable connection between the two letters when a thud of feet on the wooden stairs below made us all look up. "They are coming back," Stoichev said quietly. He put the letter away, and I placed ours with it for the time being in his safekeeping. "Mr. Ralph, he was assigned to you as your guide?" "Yes," I said quickly. "And he seems far too interested in our work here. There is a lot more we must tell you about our research, but it's rather private. And also," I paused, "dangerous?" inquired Stoichev, turning his wonderful old face towards us. How did you guess? I couldn't hide my amazement. Nothing we had said so far implied danger. "Ah," he shook his head, and I heard in his sigh a depth of experience and regret I couldn't begin to fathom. "There are some things I should tell you also. I never expected to see another of these letters. Talk to Mr. Ranoff as little as possible."
However, despite these points, this is a compelling novel. Some scenes confer favourably with many horror writers, and Kostova summons and maintains a sense of growing threat through the book. As a debut novel, it is very impressive, both in quality and quantity. It was the first debut to reach number one on the New York Times bestseller list and has won a number of awards and continues to gather readers and reviews, despite the fact it was published 18 years ago. Kostova has written several more novels, both of them standalone stories, but The Historian remains her best known and most popular work. If you haven't read it, I can recommend you give it a go. It will reward on many levels.
Well, there we are, the thoughts of Jenny on this particular epic. And I'm always tempted to use the term magnum opus because it certainly was a substantial text that Elizabeth Kostova has put together in The Historian. But let's find out what Rob Nichols made of not a light read, it has to be said, but perhaps quite an adventurous read. And for those of us who can recall maybe our first encounter with Dracula lore, vampiric lore, either through Christopher Lee and Hammer Horror or late night screenings on Tynes television of and BBC Two, of course, of the lines of Bela Lugosi and so on. What an interesting take on the whole legend.
Yes, absolutely. As you say, it was a long read, but it certainly, you got through the pages very quickly because of the style that it was written in. And it was we could say it's updating the tale, but not in a way that we've seen recently from American sort of productions on TV, because this was kind of a hark back to Bram Stoker, who is cited many times, his Dracula, through the book. It's almost written as append as, well, it's a historian, so it's written by various historian people as narrators, but almost like it's a Victorian book in itself. So lots of sort of really nice phraseology and everything, and divided up in a way where we're constantly going back in time to look at different people's lives. And reading letters and etc., but it all works so well. You don't get mixed up at any point. You know where you are. You know how it's flowing, and it's definitely a gripping tale, which I think is a rare feat when you talk about something like this subject, because you're always constantly thinking, well, we've heard it all before about vampires and Dracula. We know how it ends. It doesn't end. So I thought it was, a really good piece of work. I think hats off to be able to do something that's a genre that's so, that there's so much of it out there, but to do it in a fresh way, but in a way where you immediately recognize all the sort of familiar haunts and the familiar sort of works like Bram Stoker, as I say, that constantly underpins it.
Certainly, the
So.
way in which it addresses more than 500 years of history, and started thinking because of the way in which Kostova introduces characters that we know, such as Hitler, such as Napoleon, such as Stalin, of course, and really addresses the post-World War II coming down of the Iron Curtain across Europe, and the notion that one of the lines is a bit like a Raiders of the Lost Ark thing, basically, that if
Yeah.
Stalin had actually got hold of a kind of device that could create immortality, then his particular atrocities could go on forever and ever. And I think that that comparison between the historical character of Vlad the Impaler, clue is in his name, presumably, and the atrocities that we see still visited. I mean, we saw this obviously with respect to situations in the Middle East with the Gaza Strip recently. We saw the incursions there. I think Kostova manages to really address that inhumanity in a way that actually does make you think and does connect with the modern reader, even though this, of course, was written 18 years ago.
Yes, that's right. Yes, you're right. That an awful lot has happened in the last 18 years. An awful lot has happened in the last 18 months. As you, but this does teach you to look back into history and and look at the patterns of history, because that's what they're looking at, the patterns, to try and see evidence of something. I like the idea that of that Vlad the Impaler might have started germ warfare, for instance, and I love this kind of the sort of traditions that have been passed, secret societies that have passed through the ages, as well as well as the vampires, the undead. But yeah, and intriguing to go behind the Iron Curtain and see these different countries, as they were, and very interesting to go back to these back again, and of course that's a thing with when you're talking about the undead, it doesn't matter that there's no finality, that but I was glad to see that it was actually a book in itself, because you know that always drives me mad. You get to the end and it's like there's 20 different things.
Yeah, I
But
mean, I think.
and a fascinating travelogue, really, a travelogue through a travelogue in two ways, a travelogue through Europe, but also through like a timeline, as you say, going through 500 years, which is you learn a lot, don't you, through it, reading it.
I mean, there's also that indication that on some level, there's an argument that that power of evil. I mean, you mentioned Joan Warfare, of course, one of the sad reflections on the development of the Americas was, of course, the Native Americans were actually given blankets that were infected with smallpox to again decimate their population. So, you know, again, in the 19th century, that's something else which perhaps doesn't reflect well in terms of the way in which the expansion westwards was actually carried out. And the strategies that were actually there. That's for another book, of course. There was a part of me which kind of felt there were elements of Da Vinci Code. There were elements, obviously, of academia, which I recognized from a time which has probably long since gone now, where you actually would have that close relationship with your supervisor. And you would, in the case of Mr. Rossi, if you really kind of felt passionately, would go out and seek the whole thing through. And then, of course, there's the notion of, what an unlucky family they were to actually have that connection going all the way down the bloodlines. And again, I thought the description of the grandmother, the aunt, the ways in which obviously Helena Rossi effectively developed her whole skill set and her mindset and wanted to actually prove that basically she could do anything her father could. And of course, the resolution of that when we see how that had manifested itself. I thought that was really well handled, and actually, there was no point really where I felt credibility was being stretched to breaking point. That, you know, in essence, the whole rationale with the whole thing was something where you could almost feel yourself being carried along by the narrative.
Is that like the there was something on TV last week about Agatha Christie, and they were talking about how that the at that time there was an agreement that there was a certain code, and that you should you know that it's possible to follow to see who's done it. It's they don't introduce some a character halfway through the book And in that way, wasn't it, that there's nothing introduced that's just ridiculous at any point. And yeah, you can see, and I love the sort of device. It's the old fashioned way, isn't it? That letters and things like that are the big clues. And right the way through, it's the historian and the libraries and the archives that they're the sacred things, and they mean a lot to Vlad as well. So it's very traditionalist in that point, but they're sort of good values in a way, aren't they, to uphold?
Again, it's that physicality. I mean, clearly, if it was written in 2023, inevitably people would start saying, "But what about the internet? What about searching online? What about online material, etc.?" And that would take away, I think, from one of the key ways in which the reader is brought in, that notion of actually searching archive. The kind of thing that actually you used to do at Middlesbrough Central Library, if you wanted to delve deep in a particular archive scenario, you'd go up to the top floor, you might have, you know, ancient. And I do remember one of the founders of Book of the Month, Jill Appleton, saying how, you know, certain rooms in the library were kept at specific temperatures, you know, to preserve paperwork and to actually keep that notion. I mean, obviously they still exist, but it's interesting how that developed. Lots of characters to choose from, of course, from Stephen Barley, who of course was Master James's student and one of the, I suppose, young heroes together with the narrator of the piece. So we obviously
he's a cool
have...
customer, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's
I thought so.
You know,
I mean,
very
I,
calm under crisis and very unflustered.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of tend to suggest at times maybe he stretched a little bit of credibility. You have, of course, Vlad Tepes himself as introduced. And again, I think given what Christopher Lee would always say, he tried to imbue in his incarnation of Dracula the sense of nobility, the sense of conflicting views and areas from that. But at the same time, this unremitting commitment to a way of the undead. And again, you know, I have to say, given a choice between the two, I think I'll go vampires as opposed to zombies, which is obviously another popular trope that's used to explore sort of areas. I don't know how many zombies here. But who stood out to you in terms of characters that you felt were folk that particularly sort of made a line? Given, of course, you know, Paul, the narrator's father, also kind of has a key role and the notion of how they were developing that. The Rossis, of course, Bartholomew Rossi, the monks, of course. I mean, so many really that you can actually go with.
I think Paul really, a lot of it is his voice, isn't it? And he's very human because he kind of loses his cool and loses his temper a few times when he shouldn't do. I think, but also, Rossi himself as well. It's very clever though, the way they introduce the fear into it and how each person is exploring it and then steps back because they realize what's at stake for them and what's at stake for their families, etc. But then they're drawn back into it many years later. They're very persistent, Rossi and his pupil, and they're very loyal as well, aren't they?
I got to honest, I had a bit of a soft spot for one of the singers who I think was Baba. I thought you know, Firewalker, who was there. But if I was pushed, I'd probably go for Helen Rossi. Although, and this is where I felt it did stretch a little bit. I thought her escape route, where she dives over a cliff, no spoiler. Kind of that was pushing it a little bit in terms of, but you know, maybe divine providence was looking after and clearly her viewpoint. I mean, one of our Romanian students that might be joining us in future sort of shows, or maybe this one if we connect together, I was actually sharing about, is this an accurate reflection of the Romanian character? That, you know, you have this kind of wistfulness and you have the tension, obviously, with the Balkans. I mean, we obviously saw with the, and indeed, mini spoiler, the fact that the narrator's father, effectively as a diplomat, ends up losing his life by stepping on a landmine in the Kosovo conflict, I think is quite an interesting way in which that match between known historical facts and variations on that fact were quite interesting. I also was struck by, just from a personal point of view, the century, the 15th century, at the same time as in England, we're dealing with the Wars of the Roses, Henry the Seventh comes to power, etc. Clearly, you have all this Byzantine fall of Constantinople, battles, etc., going on, proving that actually maybe war, a global conflict, isn't necessarily just restricted to the 21st century, as indeed Dracula sort of makes play when he actually says how efficient in the 20th century was the Hiroshima and Nagasaki usage in terms of wiping out life.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we see the barbarism in the Middle Ages, but we see it on a scale where a city can be wiped out now. So yeah, and take your points about that century, the 15th century, and of course that was the for Europe before that was the Crusades, but that was the big thing, that the fall of Constantinople was like the end of the classical period. Or had that already ended, Alex, when Christendom descended in the, you know.
I think we were beginning to exit the medieval periods and begin to enter the Renaissance period, which obviously was, post the schism and the church's scenario from that point of view, and Henry VIII and so on. But lots of things happening, which again I thought were woven into the text and the narrative in a way which you never at one stage felt, yeah, okay, this is just
No,
preposterous in terms of the
no,
way
no.
forward. So.
And I think anybody reading this might go away from this, and obviously it's a big read in itself, but might look at different facets of history from this, because we get the Turkish side of it, obviously, and that is quite interesting to see both sides of that situation. But also, would you really want Vlad the Impaler on your side? I don't know, as your defender. Because you might well end up on a stake, just if he feels that he feels that way about you that day.
Which, of course, curiously, was exactly the feeling that I know my own father had with respect to, as he did, a lot of Poles had, about the Yalta Agreement, where, of course, the allies were Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt against Adolf Hitler. Stalin not necessarily being, and it's interesting that, he's directly referenced in terms of somebody who maybe not the nicest of individuals, but
No,
there you go.
no.
Okay, marks out of 10 then, Rob. I mean, I'll be controversial and say that I much, even though it was slightly longer, I much preferred this, and I found it an easier read and a better read than the Anne McCaffrey text that we looked at lastly. I really, Jenny might say that's sacrilege, but I felt that that was one which I never quite kind of connected with. This one, I think, did work for me, and I'm going to go for a 9.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a 9 as well. It was it did take a to take quite some time to get through it, but it was rewarding each page that you turned, and it had a great style to it and great pace to it, and yeah, a very good read.
Well, we've just heard of what Rob Nichols thought of the joys of the historian. I've actually had it on my own bookshelves for probably about 18 years. So it was a great trepidation that I sort of thought, okay, I'll go with this. It is a substantive text. It's over 600 pages, but it does play around very nicely with the vampire legends as opposed to Dracula, etc. And we've been joined for Book of the Month by one of our regular correspondents, of course. I think actually, Jessica Burtis, do we say you've actually got your MA in children's literature now, or is that still in the pipeline?
I got my results. Actually, I saw my results a couple days ago, and I'll be graduating in April, but I have completed it, so I officially have all my results. So that's a
Congratulations.
congratulations.
Thank you.
See, d double success, an MA in children's literature, and of course, most valuable contributor for the Arthur Weingarten
Yes.
Award for the Midweek Drive as well. So it just goes to show, classic. Jessica, is this a book that appeals to you? I mean, I appreciate that when I just reminded you about the Book of the Month 2 days ago, I thought there's no way she's going to be able to read 630 odd pages in terms of that. I mean, I know she's good, but that wouldn't work. What about the thoughts in terms of what Jenny's described?
I think you have made it sound even more intriguing than I already thought it was, because now I've gotten to kind of see how, even from the description you gave, how so much of it seems to mirror and kind of call back to Dracula, like with the descriptions of the settings. Because I remember in Dracula, it's not so much dialogue focused or even action focused. It's more they describe the setting so much. You really are set in the mountains in Romania, and it sounds like that this book also pays a lot of attention to trying to have similarities to those iconic vampire stories. But I also think it's just interesting because Vlad the Impaler is one of those historical figures who I think, like many just legendary figures, has been turned into an image that's completely different to the historical person. So a lot of us know Dracula, but we don't really have an understanding of who Vlad Dracul was. And I think that that kind of interweaving of his life, but then also with all of the stories that have been made now, it seems like such an intriguing plot to have. And I honestly just also love the whole Indiana Jones kind of trope with the professor and the student running around on fantastical adventures. So I think it just sounds great. I think it sounds worth the 600 pages.
As I said earlier, it might be sacrilege to Jenny's ears, but I preferred this much more than the Anne McCaffrey epic, which was also substantially long, but that was a lot more challenging. I think I shared with this with you before, Jessica. In terms of the Bram Stoker homage, in many ways, Jenny, I mean, I think Jessica's called it quite right there. I mean, Rob also referred to the travelogue, which is something else you referred to. That kind of worked overall. I mean, I think once you actually get into the rhythm of the whole thing and realize this is one very unlucky family that we're dealing with here, it panned out okay.
I think it did. It's extremely well written, and it's obvious that she has a great love for these areas. She describes them in a way that is really loving and caring, and it means that the sort of image we have of Stalinist blocks of grey towers and everything else just melt away in front of this absolutely astonishing scenery in these beautiful areas. I'm actually reminded of I watch cycling a lot, particularly in the summer with the Grand Tours. But in between the grand tours, you get these interesting little travelogues to the most unlikely places you've never even heard of. Come to beautiful Kyrgyzstan, and they have the most gorgeous images of lakes and forests and people cycling and everything. And you look and you think, we never imagine the rest of the world looks as good as this. And she does that with this book. It reminds me of that. She shows us how beautiful a lot of these places that we just go to holiday on in Bulgaria, you're joking. Maybe we should. Maybe it really is that lovely.
Of course, you have Bulgaria, you have the other Balkan countries, of course, Romania very much to the fore here. We have the connection with Athens, as well as, of course, Holland and the Netherlands, which is also part of the whole process. What about favorite characters, Jenny? I mean, I'm sort of thinking we should have an honorable mention for Master James, who obviously manages to rescue the whole thing in the end. Or was it Elsie, perhaps, the system that. I probably went for Helen Rossi in the end, as I've just said, with respect to Rob. Rob was very much focusing on the narrator. I mean, there are lots of characters that come through and lots of academic characteristics that are kind of, seen and portrayed for us. A time really in academia, which I'm not sure it still exists, actually. I mean, I think that 18 years ago there was a thought that this was there, and I can envisage certainly the kind of scholarly activity that's actually there. I think that's changed slightly. But anyway, what about your favorite character or characters, Jenny?
Definitely Helen. Rod of iron, that woman. I think she's wonderful. She starts off in a very unlikely place and she ends up being so strong and so brave and works so hard to save her daughter. I think Helen is magnificent.
The only slight challenge I have with that, as I mentioned earlier in the program, I wasn't entirely convinced, and maybe this is the writing, I wasn't entirely convinced by when she actually dove off the cliff at the end, really. I kind of thought that was that there could have been a better way of kind of addressing that particular aspect, because she was very, very fortunate if she did survive it, that
Yes.
is.
Yes. Running water kills a vampire. If she's going to be bitten again, that's it. She's gone.
Yeah,
Yeah.
precisely.
I think I'd probably dive off a cliff as well under those circumstances.
So, is the vampire trope never ending, Jenny? Is it a case of, clearly what Bram Stoker tapped into, and obviously Sheridan Le Fanu did with the earlier scenarios, and even Mary Shelley with the vampire? I think there were lines within that. Is this something which, a bit like zombies, we are do well, say doomed, we'll constantly have? Because there is, of course, no sign of a sequel, I don't think, that Costover has actually been planning. But there is the opening at the end of the text that maybe, just maybe, there might be a kind of re-emergence.
Possibly there might, but She's turned to exploring slightly different things in her other two novels. As far as vampires generally are concerned, I think that idea is going to be with us for a very long time. It's like werewolves. It's a folk legend that isn't going to die, I suspect. And people, a bit like Sherlock Holmes, people will just keep writing about it. At least she's got a lot of originality in hers, which I like.
So, Jessica, is this a novel which you think, yeah, that's over the festive period when I'm not actually sort of dealing with all of the family challenges in North Carolina, this is one I'm going to go for?
No, I definitely want to. I will. I've got my new library card, so I need to make more use of it. And I love a good vampire story. I am a John Polidori supremacist when it comes to vampire stories. I think that his The Vampire is unparalleled. But I'm excited to see how this one goes because it just sounds so unique with how many different things it combines. So I think it'll be really cool to really sit down with this and read once it's like a cold January night. Maybe I can pretend I'm somewhere in Romania.
And we could always get Anna Coscanel to actually connect with you as well from that point of view. She could obviously provide some Romanian aspects as well. I never thought I'd actually hear the time, Jenny, where we'd have I'm considered John Polidori supremacist, which is quite interesting from that point of view. But it just sort of o opens up the whole side of things. Of course, I was thinking with similar contemporary to Shelley, but Polidori was the soul. Marks out of 10, then, Jenny. What are you going to go for?
I'm going to give it 8.5. I think it's a bit too long and it's a bit too repetitive in places as they keep retracing the same journey. But nevertheless, it's an absolutely stonking story, and for a debut novel, it's quite astonishing.
I'll stay with 9, which was pretty much Rob's score as well, and we both had it on a 9. The challenge was primarily not necessarily the sort of the length of the whole piece, but also I think it was a hearkening back to the day where, as in the days of Dickens, of course, and Arthur Conan Doyle, these would be serialized. And I think if it had been serialized, it would have probably sort of carried together with it all being collected together into one mammoth volume. It possibly did take time to work through that, but as I say, I think generally very well and very well put together and richly done. What's up next, Jenny? And I do think this is a novel that Jessica Burtis has already interviewed the author and has addressed from that point of view. Michael Hinkson, I believe.
Oh, well, I shall absolutely have to be on top of my game then. It's Running with Roselle by Michael Hinkson, and I'm really looking forward to this one.
Indeed, how a blind boy and a puppy grew up, became best friends, and together survived one of America's darkest days. Michael Higson, with Jeanette Hanscom, Running with Roselle. And obviously, as a canine friend, basically, Jessica, so Jessica and Jenny, you're probably sort of keen to sort of investigate this.
Absolutely.
Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting, podbean.com, probably the best download decision you'll ever make.